Today I talked to Scott Davis about his new book, Lessons from the Titans. The book is filled with illuminating case studies and brilliant in-depth analysis. This valuable book provides a multitude of insights that will help you weather market upheavals, adapt to disruptions, and optimize your resources to your best advantage. Enjoy the interview. Welcome to the Exponential Organization podcast. I'm your host, Lance Pepler. The purpose of this podcast is to bring you thought leaders from around the world, giving input into how you and your organization can grow exponentially. The show is sponsored by Ideastorm, a leading exponential growth consultancy. They can provide services ranging from an hour advisory call with a network of over 5,500 consultants worldwide through OpenExo through to the 10-week EXO Sprint. So visit www.ideastorm.co.za to find out more. Won't you do me a favor? If you like this podcast, won't you tell others about it? That would be fantastic. Now, on with the interview. Today, our guest is Scott Davis. Scott serves as Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Melius Research, where he is also the lead research analyst covering the multi-industry sector. He brings 25 years of industrial equity research experience to Melius and has covered over 30 multi-industry names with an aggregated market capitalization of approximately $1 trillion. Scott is the co-author of Lessons from the Titans, and that's what we're going to be speaking to him about today. The book is filled with illuminating case studies and brilliant in-depth analysis. This invaluable book provides a multitude of insights that will help you weather market upheavals, adapt to disruptions, and optimize your resources to your best advantage. You'll learn hard-won lessons in innovation, growth, resilience, and operational excellence, proven fundamentals of conscious improvements for lasting success. So welcome to the podcast, Scott.
Thank you, Lance. I'm happy to be here.
It's fantastic having you. Scott, where am I speaking to you from today?
Well, I had planned on being in our New York City office, but there's a hurricane coming through eastern United States. So I'm in the suburbs at my home, and hopefully we don't get too much rain and wind today. But if you hear some sound in the background, it may be a bit of a hurricane.
And where are your offices? Are they on the island itself?
Yeah, our offices are in Midtown Manhattan, really actually very close to where my offices have been my entire career. I've always been in within a few block area in Manhattan, which is kind of unusual.
And talking about your career, could you possibly give us a brief overview of your career to date and the company Melius Research?
Sure, Lance. I came to Wall Street in 1990 and I never left. And as I just mentioned, I've actually been within the same few blocks in Midtown Manhattan. I was at Morgan Stanley for many years, which is in the Times Square area. And then I left Morgan Stanley. I was running their global industrials group for about 16 years or so. And I left Morgan Stanley. I went across the street to Barclays Bank, which was the old Lehman Brothers facility. And I had the same job at Barclays Bank for 6 or 7 years, covering industrial stocks and also running the global industrials team, so the folks in Europe and Japan and in Asia in general, in Latin America, we spoke to quite frequently and collaborated with on global industrial companies. So most of my focus has been on the large conglomerates, the GEs of the world, the Honeywells, the Danahers, Emerson Electric. I mean, the big, you know, including 3M, et cetera, the big global players. And I've traveled around the world visiting facilities and covering these stocks and these companies for close to 3 decades now. Now, 3 years ago, 15 colleagues and I decided to start our own firm called Melius Research. And it's an independent research shop that specifically focuses on industrials research and data related to industrials research. So we've had a lot of fun. We've built a business from scratch that we're really proud of, and I think the book is something that we always wanted to write, and we couldn't write it when we were at a bank. They would never allow you to write a book. So being an independent firm, we're able to write and tell these stories, which we just think are just fantastic stories that we wanted to share with the world.
And I'd love you to share one or two with me, us on this podcast as well. But thank you so much for the book and huge congratulations, Lessons from the Titans. So what brought you to write this book? What was the purpose for writing the book?
Well, we felt like industrials have been lost in this, in the intoxication of the internet. Industrials have been lost, and people forgot that industrials were the original tech sector. You know, if you go back 100 years ago, inventions like jet engines and locomotives and even farm equipment and construction equipment, all these things were developed by industrial companies that were in their day were the Googles and the Microsofts of the world. And we felt like people had lost that and had lost touch with that reality. And that the companies that succeeded and the companies that failed, quite frankly, because we looked at both successes and failures, provided a tremendous storyline to follow of really of what we think the new tech world is going to experience post-disruption. And we think we're getting to that stage now where the tech world is going to have to start making smart decisions around capital allocation, smart decisions around their operational operations and operational excellence, what we call, around their culture, which obviously very important nowadays to have a constructive culture for your organization. And we saw some signs, and WeWork, for example, Uber, companies that were going down the wrong path culturally. And we felt like there was an opportunity to tell the stories of industrial companies that have made mistakes and how they got by them and the decisions that were made to succeed and, quite frankly, decisions that were made that led to failure. And we think you can learn from both.
Talking about that, in the very first almost paragraph of your book, you make the statement, and we spend tremendous effort looking for signs of arrogance. It's the most common attribute of failure. And so you were talking about successes and failures, and we'll get onto more of that later. That why do you say arrogance is the most significant sign to look out for companies that fail?
Yeah, Lance, it's really tricky because you want a certain amount of swagger in your entrepreneurs, right? I mean, entrepreneurs always have a bit of swagger and confidence or they wouldn't be entrepreneurs, right? I mean, you have to have the confidence to be able to go it alone. And, you know, but there's a transitional period when you move past that entrepreneurial kind of disruptive phase into more of a sustainable phase where arrogance suddenly becomes a liability. It is no longer helpful to the organization. And that swagger really can lead to lots of bad things. It can lead to cultural confusion. It can lead to complacency, which really, we found that many, if not most of our great industrial companies over the course of multiple decades were reinvented themselves. And so complacency is extraordinarily dangerous, and it's a byproduct of arrogance. Grandiose visions. I mean, companies that are trying to, do perhaps too much. And another part of arrogance is just lack of process, just winging it and too much winging it, too much art, and not enough science, if you will. And we are huge advocates on the whole concept of process in filtering out and eliminating arrogance. You know, if you're constantly benchmarking yourself to best in class peers, even outside of your industry or more particularly definitely outside of your industry, it brings you back down to earth and you'll find, geez, we're not as special as we once thought we were in many instances. And it exposes flaws that you can work to correct. So arrogance is a bit of a buzzword. It has a connotation around celebrity behavior and things like that, that are negative. It's tricky though. It's a little complicated because, like you said, you want a little bit of swagger in your entrepreneurs, but there's a phase of your business where you need to transition into a humbler state.
Mm. Yeah, I interviewed quite a few people about Jeff Bezos, and he is very, very strong on the day one mentality, where he says, stay in day one. If you go into day two, which is the sign of arrogance, then that will lead eventually to stasis and decay and sort of irrelevance after a while.
Yeah, I love that. And Bezos, he's an incredible leader.
Now, I'm also a big fan of the Jim Collins flywheel. I use it in my own business and businesses that I try to engage with. And you also seem to be a fan of the Jim Collins flywheel. Can you tell us about your version of it and how it plays a role in businesses today?
Sure. Lance, we've got several different versions. We kind of play around with it. We had some fun with it in the book, and we put a couple different versions in the book that are very similar. And obviously, Jim Collins was an inspiration for that. And we are big fans of Jim's overall and the work that he's done. In fact, our publisher, when they accepted the manuscript, really said that they thought it was a really good updated version of Good to Great, kind of the modern day.
Fantastic.
Which, which is a great compliment. I hope it's true, but what we certainly hope that we stay true to the spirit of the work that Jim Collins has set out to do in his life. As far as how we look at it, you know, we have three variables in the book that we really focus in on. One is operational excellence. It's kind of the start of the flywheel, if you will, that sets the tone for the organization and delivers the cash flow that's needed to do everything else. So that's operational excellence at point one. Second one is culture. And, you know, culture really to us enables the repeatability of success even while leaders change. That the organization can weather lots of changes in business conditions, et cetera, and changes in leaders. That's culture, number two. And then the third point is reinvestment / reinvention. And really, reinvestment to us delivers the growth that widens the moat. You know, you have to invest in your business. And we found that the most successful industrial companies over decades and even, quite frankly, north of a century were companies that were constantly reinvesting, in fact, reinvesting at fairly high levels in their organization overall. So they take the cash flow from being operationally excellent, which, you know, in many ways is about lean manufacturing and just having amazing factories and you know, amazing productivity in your software organization if you're a tech company. It then moves to culture, then moves to reinvestment. And then there's 5 points for our flywheel. The fourth point is just the flywheel then compounds the results, and it keeps investors interested. You know, if you're a public company, you get permission to buy investors to reinvest, and that's really important. So delivering results is important to investors. And then the last point of flywheel is that engaged investors provide the space and the time necessary for management to be able to pivot and reinvent. So what we do with our flywheel is we bring investors into it because, you know, the lens that we live in, a Wall Street lens, of course, after several decades of doing this job with this particular lens, is that we've seen companies fail, quite frankly, just because investors gave up. Activists come in, they force them to break apart or perhaps make decisions that maybe the founders or the leaders wouldn't make on their own. And we found that engaged investors and companies that we cover, for example, like Danaher or Honeywell, where engaged investors really gave management the time and the space to kind of fail before you succeed, right? I mean, to really trust the vision and believe in the vision and give it time to play out because nothing happens overnight. So our version of the flywheel is just a little bit different because it starts with the operational excellence, but it ends with engaged investors.
Wonderful. Just on a slightly side tangent, I was interviewing Dr. Rita McGraw, and she said that one of the problems with innovation, just like your flywheel, is that organizations are doing, you know, stock buybacks and stuff like that, and investing in that rather than investing in their organization and investing in their innovation itself. Do you have an opinion on that?
Yeah, I do. I just gave a board presentation a week ago where to a large auto company, and I spoke about this exact point. Just to give you some numbers, today's industrial world only spends about 3.5% of sales on R&D in the United States. In Europe, spend about 4.5% of sales on R&D. And the tech world spends closer to 10% of sales on R&D. And we have really found that our most successful companies over time spend kind of 6% or more of sales on R&D. So we're not advocating to a specific number other than just stating that historically, companies that have reinvested fairly heavily in their own businesses, assuming, of course, you have appropriate investment, you know, you're investing in the right things, which is a whole, you know, really a whole focus of our book. We do think that companies need to invest more heavily in their own businesses in general. And we would say that one of the reasons perhaps why industrial companies have become less relevant in this new world we live in is because they've invested less aggressively. Now, the best of the best have still invested pretty robustly, but many others just have not.
So it would be wonderful if you could tell us one of your stories. In your book, you feature 11 companies, and perhaps you could tell us about General Electric, their rise and fall. Don't give away all the secrets of your book, but obviously Jack Welch was incredibly successful, and it's obviously less successful today. Could you possibly give us a high-level overview of what made them so successful and what caused their decline?
Yeah, absolutely. GE chapter was incredibly fun to write, and I've covered that stock for a very long time. I've spent hundreds of hours, thousands of hours, really, with the company, around the company over my career, traveling with them around the world and learning, first with Jack Welch and then with Jeff Immelt, learning good and bad. Now, Jack Welch was really a part of the inspiration for the Mealy's version of the flywheel, you know, really taking the foundation that Jim Collins laid out. When Jack Welch started as CEO at GE, the first thing he did is fix the company operationally and raise the investment levels. So he took a lot of costs out of the business. He was known as Neutron Jack because he took expenses out of the business. But that doesn't tell the story, really. I mean, he took the excessive expenses out of the business, but he took those savings that he created and he put it and he invested it back in the company. He did a tremendous job. You know, he was one of the first early pioneers of lean manufacturing in America. America was late. The Japanese were well ahead of the Americans, and Jack caught on. He brought Six Sigma into GE aggressively over his tenure, and really focused on making sure that he had highly invested in factories that were low cost and automated. But frankly, he was an early adopter of automation. He built culture really around accountability more than anything else. But culture was extremely strong in the Jack Welch days. And then he really made some incredible investment decisions, which I would say his hit rate on investments were amazing. So, for example, he bought RCA back in 1986. RCA owned the NBC television network and a bunch of other assets. And what he basically did is he bought RCA, he kept NBC, and essentially sold off all the other assets and ended up with NBC for free, literally for free, and a tremendous investment. He also traded, GE was a big manufacturer of televisions at the time, and he sold his television business to invest more heavily and buy a medical diagnostics business. And televisions went on to become a commoditized, low-margin business over time, and medical diagnostic equipment went on to be an incredible growth area. And that was just, you know, that was the case in Jack Welch's career. So look, in the later days of his career, there was arrogance crept into the organization, and the accounting was questionable in GE Capital, for example. But we focused most of the chapter on Jack Welch really around all the brilliant things that he did over the course of a fairly long career at GE. Of course, he did have his faults. And, you know, his biggest fault was in bringing on his successor, Jeff Immelt, who turned out to be just the wrong leader for GE at that time. You know, Jeff Immelt did essentially the opposite of what Jack Welch did. He didn't invest in the factories. He let the factories starve. He stopped focusing on Six Sigma and Lean and was not a process-oriented person. He was very much all about the art of the job and not about the process of the job. And of course, we focus on our book talking about how critical process is overall. Over time, arrogance really, which started before Jeff Immelt got there, in 2001, but arrogance really came to dominate the culture at GE. You know, Jeff Immelt was famous for his two airplanes flying around. You know, he always had a backup airplane in case one of his airplanes broke down. And of course, in one of my meetings with one of my kind of infamous conversations with Jeff Immelt, he bragged about how he had a separate airplane fly his fitness equipment down to a hotel the day before. So he had his own personal fitness equipment traveling around the world with him, and tremendous excesses in that organization. And, you know, it doesn't take long for employees and customers and suppliers to take notice of the arrogance in the organization and start to act poorly as a result. And then the last part really that Jeff Immelt did the opposite of, and Jack Welch, was just he made very bad investments. He ended up selling the NBC TV network to Comcast for a very low price, and he bought Alstom, the power turbine manufacturer, the French-owned power turbine manufacturer, for a large price. And that, you know, that ended up really defining his career at GE. It nearly bankrupted the company, and now GE today, it's a $6 stock. You know, really struggling to stay alive in this pandemic. It was full of debt by the time Jeff Immelt left. He had he had levered the company to the hilt, and the cash flow was minimal, and the debt was high, and now the company is really struggling. Luckily, there's a new CEO who's more process-driven in Larry Culp, but the damage has already been done to the company, to the reputation, to really where it fits in society, its communities. All the stakeholders, I think, have been big losers in the Jeff Immelt era, unfortunately.
Wow, that is astonishing to compare two leaders against each other like that in the same company, and the success of one and the failures of another. That's incredible. I think people should read your book just to read those two chapters on General Electric itself. Apart from Honeywell, and what are the other companies that you highlight? It's General Electric and Honeywell and a few others?
Yeah. We focus in on 11 different stories, and they're all very unique. We handpicked them out of hundreds that we looked at that we could have told, and intimately could have told probably more than 100. And we picked each one because they told a different story. And in some cases, the story was a feel good story, like a Danaher, building a company from nothing into $100+ billion organization, or a Honeywell and a big turnaround and saving hundreds of thousands of jobs and creating tremendous amount of wealth for so many employees and investors. Mm-hmm. There's some really great stories in that regard. There's some more tragic stories, like I mentioned, the GE, there's United Technologies, Boeing. We wrote the Boeing story of the ups and downs of Boeing and the challenges there. There's a fun story that we wrote with Roper and a CEO, legendary CEO, unfortunately passed away a couple years ago. Brian Jellison was his name. We talked about Caterpillar. We talked about Stanley Black & Decker, United Technologies, TransDigm. It's really, and I think in each individual case, whether you're comfortable or know the company, you're intimate to the company or not intimate to the company, we try to tell a story that at least gives some sort of business lesson that is applicable to today's tech world or healthcare world or any other business, quite frankly.
Has this interview with Scott inspired you to buy his book, Lessons from the Titans? Then can I ask you to go to my website? That's www.ideastorm.co.za. Click on the Buy Books tab and buy the book from there. You'll also find the other best-selling books that have been featured on this podcast. That will help give a bit of financing to this podcast and help to continue to improve it. Thank you for doing this. Scott, can you tell us a little bit more about Melius and the services that you do, you provide to customers?
Absolutely. We are an independent research shop. Most of our customers are larger money managers, whether they're mutual funds or hedge funds or pensions, institutions of some sort managing money. We provide advice on the industrial space overall, not just industry expertise, but actually advice on which companies we would advocate for long-term stock ownership or not. We also have a data analytics business that goes alongside that provides data and analytics around a number of different sectors, not just industrials, but also healthcare and consumer and autos. But our focus today is primarily on the broad industrial group. We plan on expanding down the road, but today our focus is on industrial research. We have a website if anybody wants to find out additional information. It's www.meliusresearch.com. Mm-hmm. Melius is spelled M-E-L-I-U-S. But it's meliusresearch.com. And, Lessons from the Titans is the book that we hope that people get introduced to Melius through the book.
Super. I'll have those details in the show notes. And you've got a separate section on the website for the book as well that people can access there.
Correct.
That's brilliant. Scott, how else can people get hold of you? Can they contact you on LinkedIn or other social media or follow what you do?
LinkedIn is... I'm not fancy enough to use Twitter, but we use LinkedIn to connect with folks around the world, and I find it to be a tremendous tool overall. So that would be grand.
So thank you so much, Scott, for joining me today. I really, really appreciate it, and I hope your book goes from strength to strength. I found it a fascinating read. So thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure, Lance. Take care.
So this was Scott Davis, and his book is Lessons from the Titans. I'll have a link in the show notes for you to get it from Amazon, a link there, and you can go to the website, which I'll have the details. And I hope you, the listener, found this as interesting and useful as I did. If you'd like to contact me, then please do. My email is lance@ideastorm.co.za and my website is www.ideastorm.co.za. So until next time, have a fantastic week. Goodbye.